I'm Gregory Berg. As you perhaps already know, Nan Calvert, who has made a very valuable contribution to the morning show over the past 18 years with monthly environmental programs, has stepped down from that responsibility, and her February visit was her last, at least in that official capacity. In gratitude for all that Nan has contributed to this program, we are utilizing the Saturday and Sunday podcasts of the morning show to replay some of our favorite Nan Calvert interviews from the past. And here is yet another. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of our good friend, Nan Calvert, and she is exceptionally excited about today's program, I think, because we're going to be talking about an organization that has really at its heart something that is near and dear to Nan Calvert's heart. We're talking about the Botanical Club of Wisconsin, the state's only organization that is dedicated first and foremost to the study of and celebration of our native flora, our native plants. And with us is John Zaborski, who is a research associate at the Wisconsin State Herbarium, and we'll be talking about that a bit, but mostly we're going to be talking about the exploits of the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. And John is joining us via the telephone from his home in Madison. So, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And John Zaborski, via the telephone, we welcome you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you can be joining us. So, Nan, tell us about your own connection to the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. When did you first learn about them, and what sort of connection, if any, do you have with them?
Well, aside from the fact that, you know, I love native plants, I know that might be a surprise to some people, but they have a wonderful Facebook page for the Botanical Club of Wisconsin that, you know, once you associate yourself with that page, everybody can enjoy the fruits of their labor. It's a wonderful education for both professional and amateur botanists, anybody who's interested in native plants. And I think one of the reasons that I wanted to do this today is that we often hear about Wild Ones, which is, you know, another organization near and dear to my heart, which was begun in the 70s. You hear about the prairie enthusiasts, but you don't hear that much, really, about the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. But as you said, they've been around since 1968. They do wonderful education, field trips, all kinds of things. And it's an organization that people should be aware of and support and get involved with, because it has to do with the identification and protection and restoration of our native plant habitats, which are absolutely crucial.
Very good. John, what is your specific involvement with the Botanical Club of Wisconsin?
I am the president of the club.
Oh,
currently.
So we're talking to the boss right now. Very good. So ahead of us talking specifically about the organization, let's find out a little bit about you. Tell us, please, where you're from originally, and tell us when your interest in and love of all things green in the natural world first emerged.
I'm originally from Neenah, which is up in the Fox Valley, so just a little south of Green Bay. And I've been interested in nature, animals, since I was a little boy, and really started to get interested in plants probably in like middle school or early in high school, and then knew that I wanted to do something with biology for, you know, my career. And I went to UW Stevens Point for my undergrad and ended up working in the herbarium and working with Emmett Ujavich, who people might know from his various books on Wisconsin wildflowers and Wisconsin grasses. And then that just kind of snowballed into going and getting a PhD in botany at UW-Madison, where I actually studied plants from Madagascar, but have always been interested in plants of Wisconsin and have been really an active member in the botanical clubs in the last probably like 12 years. Hmm.
And before we get into more about the botanical club, tell us about the Wisconsin State Herbarium in Madison, where you are a research associate. First of all, just give us a little background about what the herbarium is and its primary function.
Right. So a herbarium is a museum and it's a large collection of dried and pressed plants. And when botanists go out and collect plants, you know, sometimes we dig them up. If it's something smaller, we take a branch or a clipping of the flowers. And then we press those plants, dry them out, and then they get glued onto archival paper. And so then you've got this library, essentially, of plants from around the world. So the Wisconsin State Herbarium at UW-Madison is the largest herbarium in the state with over a million specimens. It's, I think, the fourth largest owned by a public university in the country, and it's in the top 20 largest herbaria in the entire country as well. And, of course, we have the largest collection in the state of plants collected in Wisconsin. And what its purpose is that this library can be used by other researchers to, you know, study the ranges of plants in a state or a country or even a county level and see what grows there. You can track through time what plants have been in an area. So we have specimens collected in the 1800s from Milwaukee by Increase Lapham, and show what was in that region, you know, over 100 years ago that is no longer there. So, you know, we have specimens of rare plants from around the state. You can track when certain invasive species came into the state. So the first record of, let's say, garlic mustard or purple loosestrife. And then as people collect and turn in these specimens, we can see, you know, how those invasive species have spread across the landscape. And then in a more, you know, modern sense, people also use the specimens to extract DNA from the leaves. So even 50-year-old specimens, you can take a small section of leaf, grind it up, carry out some chemical processes, and get DNA out of those leaves and then use that for different studies. And there's chemical analyses that people have done with specimens. People also use the herbarium to look for insect damage on plants and then track particular insect species across the landscape. So this library of what, you know, looks like a bunch of dead dried plants on paper actually has tons of different uses for research, and it's just a fantastic, priceless resource.
What are your responsibilities as a research associate?
I am currently leading a project of other botanists in the state to write a flora for Wisconsin. So a flora is a technical manual to identify any plant that grows wild in a particular area. And it can be at the country level or the state level or the county. In this case, it will be for the entire state of Wisconsin, which Wisconsin has never had. We've always had to rely on using manuals from Michigan or Illinois or ones that cover the Midwest or the Eastern United States. And this will be the first one that will let you go out into the wild, identify any wild vascular plants, so flowering plants and conifers and ferns that you might find in Wisconsin. And like I said, it's a collaborative effort, so different experts from around the state at other herbaria and universities are writing up little treatments for each of the different families that are in the state.
That must be an exciting thing to be part of. That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, this is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show, and with us via the telephone is John Zaborski, research associate with Wisconsin State Herbarium, and more to the point for our conversation from here on, president of the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. So, John, maybe we can have you expand on Nan's preliminary description of the Botanical Club of Wisconsin, which, again, was formed back in 1968. What more do you want to tell us about the organization on that sort of basic level?
Right. So we are a native plant society that's dedicated to studying as well as teaching people about all the native plants that grow in Wisconsin, and not just flowering plants, but conifers, ferns, mosses, and liverworts, algae, and lichens, which are technically not plants, but have always kind of fallen into the realm of botany. And just getting people interested in these plants and the communities in which they grow, and, you know, teaching people how to identify plants, where they grow in the state, the habitats that they grow in, and protecting those habitats. So in the past and still now, the club will go out to particular natural areas that the state owns or that counties or private individuals own, and identify all the plants on that property so that there's, you know, this checklist basis for the property so we can see what grows there. Maybe there's a rare plant that needs to be protected. Maybe there are invasive species that need to be controlled, that type of thing. We also, the dues that people pay go towards our research efforts. So every year we give out a research award to a graduate student and an undergraduate student now that are studying plants of Wisconsin. So they can either be, maybe they're looking at a particular species across its whole range and they want to come to Wisconsin and collect plants here for that DNA study or whatever it might be. That money that we put forth to them can go to that. So we've funded a couple projects looking at two rare species in the state and their genetics. One person was looking at herbivory impacts on the federally threatened dune thistle that just grows on the dunes of Lake Michigan. And then we're an organization just dedicated to, you know, bringing botanists together at both the expert and amateur level for fellowship. So meeting new people, learning about plants from across the state that maybe you didn't know about, and just like bringing everyone in the state together over plants.
I love that. That's a, what better way could there be to bring people together? One of the things that intrigued me most as I looked at the website of your organization is this whole notion of rare plant protection. Let's talk for a moment about what that designation really represents. And first of all, is that a designation that is officially given by, for instance, the Botanical Club or some other organization or agency? And in a sense, how rare does a plant need to be in order to earn that designation? And from there, what happens? I mean, what are we talking about in terms of protecting a so-called rare plant?
So that designation is given either at the federal level, and we've got, I think, 6 or 7 species that are listed as federally threatened. So the federal government looks at that species range across the entire country and determines based on the population sizes whether or not it would be listed as threatened or endangered. And then we have a number of species that at the state level are threatened or endangered. And that designation is set by the DNR. And what they're doing is looking at the populations of that species within the borders of Wisconsin. So there are some species that are rare in Wisconsin because we're just at the edge of their range. So they might be very common in Illinois or Minnesota, let's say, and westward or eastward, but they just barely get into Wisconsin. And so because that population in Wisconsin is so small and occupies maybe, let's just say, like a tiny portion of Grant County in the southwest or Kenosha County in the southeast, we consider it rare here. And so then what happens at that level is the DNR goes out and looks for these species across the different habitats where they might occur, identifies where the populations are, and then sets up management plans for, you know, controlling invasives, making sure that that habitat is high quality. Maybe it's a rare prairie plant that needs more fire. So then they go in and do prescribed burns or they clear brush. And because the DNR owns so many acres of land, they obviously can't check everywhere for these rare plants. So the Botanical Club, when we do our forays and our blitzes and different surveys, we, you know, keep an eye out for these rare plants. We'll do, you know, small population assessments when we find them and say, oh, there's, you know, 10 different individuals of this rare orchid or whatever it might be at this site. Report back to the DNR that we found it. Here's the GPS coordinates. Here's what we think, you know, the threats are, that type of thing. And then on DNR-owned land, the DNR takes over the management for that. So the Botanical Club might help find these populations, but we don't necessarily do any direct management for them.
That probably is one of those kind of relentless responsibilities. I mean, in a sense, that work is never done.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's something that you, depending on the situation, might need to come back every year, right? And a lot of these species, we may not even totally understand their ecology. So we could find this rare plant and let's say its population is in the hundreds and we think, oh, that's doing pretty well. And then in 5 years, it could just collapse and maybe there's only 5. Now, that could be a sign that something bad has happened, like maybe a non-native insect has come in there and eaten it. Maybe someone came in and destroyed them, unfortunately. Or it could just be that that species just ebbs and flows, right? So it could have boom years, and then it disappears into the seed bank, and then in 10 years comes back full force. We don't, sometimes we just don't know. And that type of research needs to be carried out, and that's the type of thing that we support.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today not only with our good friend Nan Calvert, but with John Zaborski, who is president of the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. I know that one of the things that your group does is to help foster among your members and people in the public greater understanding of how to identify plants out in the wild, so to speak. Tell us more about the way in which you go about doing that and some of the challenges that are involved in identifying plants in their native habitats correctly.
Sure. So one thing we used to do, these botany blitzes, we call them, where anybody in the club or even maybe not affiliated with the club if they wanted to, could come out into the field with us, and we would go to particular state-owned lands called state natural areas or sometimes within state parks. And we would just try to identify everything that was growing in that particular area. And it was a great way for, you know, experts to come out and identify the plants and create these checklists that I talked about. And also for amateurs to come out and learn from experts in a very laid-back setting, right? So it's not a lecture hall at a university. It's just people outside looking at flowers and ferns and things and learning about them and teaching about them. And now we've started our forays, which are much, bigger project, where we go to a part of the state that doesn't have a lot of herbarium specimens from it. So like the far northwestern part of the state hasn't had a lot of botanical collecting because it's just far away from most of the universities. Or different counties that maybe we've got a fair number of specimens from, but they're mostly old. So places like Ozaukee County, or even like the Fox Valley. And we target particular state-owned or privately owned lands in those areas. And then we go out and just collect every plant that we see within a particular site. So we end up collecting hundreds and hundreds of specimens. Our foray last year was held in Vernon and Crawford counties in the Driftless area, and we collected over 1,000 specimens of plants within just 2 days. So even though that sounds like a really intense activity, it's definitely amateur-friendly, and we tell people of all backgrounds that are in the club to come to these events because, while you may not be able to identify the plants, you're going to definitely learn how while we're out in the field, and you can contribute to it too. So we have people taking notes. We have people pressing the plants in our plant presses. There's people actually bringing the plants back to the people who are pressing them. So it's a definitely like communal affair, and you don't need any level of expertise to come along on these events. And it can be... I'm sure as an amateur, it could feel like daunting to come out there and, you know, there's people who can identify everything based on just a tiny leaf and you're just learning, but it's a very laid back atmosphere. Like I said, it's people, plant nerds want to teach what they know to everybody else. I'll say that as a self-professed plant nerd. So it's definitely friendly for everybody.
You described these events as forays. I saw on your website that you sponsor things called botany blitzes. Are those related to this, or is that just another name for what you were just describing, or what otherwise are botany blitzes?
That was an activity that we used to do. We haven't done them in the last couple of years, where we just went to one particular state natural area for just a day and just compiled a checklist. Maybe we collected some plants if there were some interesting things there. The foray was kind of like hitting multiple state natural areas over the course of a weekend and specifically just to collect herbarium specimens, whereas the blitzes were more of let's just make a checklist and then give it to the DNR because they didn't have one for this particular property. So the blitzes kind of morphed into the foray in the last couple of years.
So tell us about this process by which you take a plant and in a sense, press it and preserve it as a specimen, I suppose, like the specimens that one finds at the herbarium. What's involved in that process, and what sort of pitfalls does someone have to be careful to avoid in terms of doing that properly?
When you go out and find a plant, let's just say like a sunflower or something like that, and you want to turn it into a herbarium specimen, you need to take a section of the plant or the entire plant if it's something small and you could easily press it. And then we put it into what's called a plant press, and it's basically like a giant sandwich. So on the ends for the bread are big wooden boards, and this is probably like 12 inches long by 8 inches wide or so. And inside of it are alternating layers of cardboard and then blotter paper, which is really thick paper that wicks away water. So then you take that specimen and you put it inside of a piece of newspaper and just kind of lay it out so that it looks nice and flat, because once it's dried and flattened, you can't fix it if it looks bad. So you want to make sure that the leaves aren't overlapping one another. You might want to try to put a leaf upside down so that people that are later looking at the plant when it's glued to paper can look at what the underside of a leaf looked like, because otherwise they're going to be all glued down and you won't see them. And then you press it. So you basically just put that cardboard on top and smush it down as hard as you can. And then you tighten it, the whole press. So it's like big belt buckles around those wooden boards with the cardboard inside. And then that flattens the plant. And then back at the herbarium, we've got these very large plant dryers. So they're really tall, kind of like ovens that just have a very dry heat of about 100 degrees inside. And you put the whole press in there, and the dry air floating through inside the cabinet just dries out the plant, and then it gets completely flattened and dried out. And then we glue them down, like I said, on that archival paper, and then that's the physical specimen. And then when you're out there, you would take notes on the habitat and on the plant itself. So if you have something that's, let's say, an oak tree, you would write down that this was a tree that was 50 feet tall, you know, something about the crown or the size of the diameter of the trunk. If it's something small, you can say that there were, you know, numerous individuals of this little weed that you found in the sidewalk or something. And then you'd also just write about that habitat. So I'm in a northern mesic forest, or I'm in a prairie, or this is an aquatic plant that I took out of a lake, that type of thing. And then include GPS coordinates of where you were so that later on people can track down, you know, that population if they wanted to. So having a lot of good habitat information and information about the plant itself on the label is really important, because if someone's going to use this for research purposes 50 to 100 years from now, you want good data so that they can kind of paint a picture of what this area looked like. So a lot of really old specimens don't have a lot of data on them. They often don't even tell you necessarily where they collected them. They will just list a city or a township. And, you know, nowadays that doesn't really mean anything for where that plant might have occurred. So if you can be as specific as possible, that has much more research value down the road.
I'm glad you mentioned research, because one of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you about is the whole matter of what kinds of things typically are people researching when it comes to plants. I mean, a given plant, what is it about that plant that we don't already know, that we can only come to know by doing research on it? I mean, I guess that's a kind of a nebulous question, but in general, what are we kind of looking at? What kind of new knowledge are we getting by studying plants in this way and fueling this thing we call research?
So specimens can be used for a bunch of different research topics. So I would say the main one that people historically have used herbaria for is looking at the variation within a particular species and then perhaps within a particular genus. So let's say you look at all of the sunflowers as an example again that occur in Wisconsin. So we've got 12 or 13 species. Now, when you look at all the different specimens of the same species, you can see just how different each individual is, just like each individual human is different. So this one particular individual might have slightly wider leaves than are normal, and maybe one would have slightly thicker leaves, slightly smaller flowers, larger flowers, a different flower color. So by having, you know, hundreds of specimens of the same species from the same state or maybe even the same county, you can see that genetic variation that's in the plants. And so then people can use that to examine the taxonomy of that group. So maybe plants that grow in Maine are much different looking than plants that grow in Wisconsin, even though we consider them the same species. And then they could use that to more nuanced look at the variation and say, actually, you know, these two things are different enough that they should be called different species. So when people use these herbarium specimens, they can use them to better understand a group. So maybe there's much more diversity within this group than we thought that there was, and the herbarium specimens can kind of lead you to that conclusion, or to an opposite conclusion that says, you know, people thought that there was a ton of variation within this group and they should all be different species, but if you look at them across their range, a different botanist might say, you know, this is just highly variable species and there's not really a genetic component to this. There's not different species here. It's just one species that can be tall or short, and that's, you know, what the evidence shows. And then, like I said, with the DNA aspect, that's something that's been happening in the last 20 years and is definitely the future of biology and taxonomy too, is using these plants, extracting their DNA from different parts of the country or the state, whatever it might be, and looking at that type of variation too. So not just physical variation that you can see with your eyes, but maybe there's a lot of genetic variation within this group, and we can study it by using these specimens. And then you can use the specimens for ecological studies too. So we might, if somebody takes good notes on a specimen and says, like, you know, I collected this aster and there were hundreds of them on that particular prairie in 1920. And then someone went back to that prairie in 1940 and said, this aster seems to have died out. And then in 1960, someone goes back there and says, oh, it's actually, there's 50 of them now. So we've got that kind of scope, that history of that site and that species at that site, kind of in the data of those specimens that can kind of tell us that maybe that species disappears for a while or comes back, or maybe after a fire it comes back, so that type of thing. And then, like I said, too, people can look at the specimens for insect damage or fungal spores on them. There's lots of specimens I've looked at that have fungi growing on them, and so it's like a double specimen in that sense. So if there was a mycologist, someone who studies fungi, that wanted to come in and look for particular, you know, molds or mildews or whatever it might be on plants, they could look at those specimens and see that there's a fungus growing on them, and that all the different examples I gave for studying the plants, you could use that fungus for the same thing, same types of research.
Fascinating. How often is it that a plant disappears and in a sense disappears for good? And do we use the term extinct the way we use it, for instance, for animals?
Yes. So if it has definitely died out across the entire world, we would say that it was extinct. At the state level, there are plants that have been what we call extirpated, which means that they still exist on the planet, but they just don't exist in Wisconsin anymore. And one of those is Mead's milkweed, which is a federally endangered plant that is mostly in the Midwest, but like the southern part of the Midwest, so southern Illinois and Missouri. And there's one record of it over 100 years ago from Wisconsin, and it has not been here since, so we consider it extirpated. But in some cases, there are species that we thought no longer grow in Wisconsin that have been rediscovered. So just last year, Ryan O'Connor with the Wisconsin DNR found a green violet, it's called, which is related to the violets that people are probably familiar with, but is in a different genus and doesn't have as pretty flowers. There was only one or two records known from Grant County 60 or 70 years ago, and it had not been seen since. And then he found it up in the northwestern part of the state, and it was doing fine up there. So that was something that we had kind of considered was probably gone from Wisconsin, and it was rediscovered. It's just been hiding.
Wow. And I suppose that's that really underscores the value of a group like the Botanical Club of Wisconsin, when you have, I presume, hundreds of members fanned out across the state. You are, in a sense, like a small army who can make discoveries like the one that you just mentioned.
Right, definitely. I mean, there's just so many natural areas and even just privately owned forests throughout the state, and there's not enough botanists to go to every single one and see what's there. So relying on people that say, oh, you know, I saw this particular flower in my, you know, 40 up north, what could it be? That's really helpful to us to, you know, have a record of what might be growing somewhere that people just aren't going to be able to get to, or we just don't have the time to get to.
I wanted to ask you the scope of your activities, because Wisconsin is a big state. So do you have sort of an official headquarters, and do you have certain parts of the state to which you give particular focus, maybe depending on where your members are? Or by and large, are you surveying and studying and experiencing the entire state of Wisconsin?
We're trying to experience the entire state. So when we have, you know, these forays, we try to go to parts of the state, like I said, that are under-collected, some more rural areas. The first one was in Burnett County, so in the far northwestern part of the state. When we have our annual meeting, which is a much more laid-back affair where we have a speaker and he leads a field trip, that type of thing, so it's a more leisurely activity, we try to space that out around the state every year. So we've had them in the southeast, around Madison, in the southwest, in the northeast. We've had one in Ashland. So we try to get those around so that we can get different groups of people from around the state. And historically, the club had local chapters across the state. So there was one in the Milwaukee area. There was one in central Wisconsin. I think there was one in the far north. And they just kind of disappeared for lack of interest in them. And the club's membership was kind of waning like 12, 15 years ago. And one thing we've tried to do in the last 6 years or so is kind of bring back more activities in the club. And we started in Madison because most of the board members are in Madison, and maybe our most active membership is in the Madison area. And so we started having little monthly meetups where we had either a lecture about a plant or a habitat or something in Wisconsin. We had workshops, so we targeted particular groups of plants, and if you wanted to learn just that group of plants, you could come and listen to a little lecture about it and then see specimens of asters or bedstraws or sunflowers, whatever it was. And then when the pandemic happened, we obviously couldn't do those in person, so we switched over to Zoom, and I think that really allowed people from across the state to even become more involved, because it's very easy to attend a Zoom lecture, but it wasn't very easy for someone from, let's say, Bayfield to get down to Madison for a one-hour lecture. So we're hoping to kind of drum up more local chapters and maybe get those started again and have people, you know, in the Green Bay area get together with just each other, or people in the Stevens Point area get together with just each other and kind of maybe revive chapters, or at least just get more people interested in the club. And our membership has been growing, so I'm really happy with what has been happening with what we've kind of brought back to the club.
So I wanted to ask you, John, if you don't mind. I've certainly had this question put to me many, many times as a sister native plant nerd. Why does this matter? Why do we need to know about our native flora? Why is it important? And what does it mean for the long run?
I think, personally, that just the intrinsic value of nature, that it has a right to exist on the landscape and be untouched by human hands. So just protecting habitats, protecting the organisms that live within them is very important, right? Like, those plants and animals should have a place to live in, alongside humans, and they've got value just because they exist. And then secondly, you know, in protecting these habitats and protecting these plants, we don't know what we could lose if they're gone, right? So we know that there's lots of issues with pollinators right now, especially native pollinators, and then honeybees, of course. If those native pollinators need particular native plants or particular habitats, big stretches of prairie, maybe they're ones that need forests, you know, if we lose those habitats and lose those plants that the insects rely upon, then we're going to lose those insects, and in turn, that could damage, you know, the crops and things that we rely on. So if those native pollinators were pollinating, you know, apple trees at an apple orchard or cherries or something like that, we're going to lose that aspect as well. So there's an economic factor to that. So I think, and on both levels, there's, you know, the usefulness of nature, and then there's the beauty of nature that we should care about in both ways.
Excellent answer. Thank you.
So how much is the Botanical Club involved in the whole matter of invasives? Or do you, in a sense, philosophically feel like there's a place for everything, including those that are, in a sense, invaders?
We don't necessarily do anything with invasives. So because we're dedicated to native plants, we don't really do anything with the invasives or non-native flora. Like, when we go out on our forays, we're definitely collecting them because they're important to have in the herbarium to see what plants are out there invading. But we don't do any active, you know, work days where we go out and treat buckthorn or pull garlic mustard or anything like that. There are plenty of organizations that do that already, and the DNR does so much work on it as well. But we have tended not to do that type of work, mainly focusing just on preservation and conservation of the native species, but knowing full well that, you know, invasives are impacting them for sure.
So does that also mean that you, in a sense, don't study invasive plants? I mean, that when you go out and look at what's growing, are you in effect ignoring the invasive species, or just taking brief note of them, but not paying attention to them the way you pay attention to native plants?
No, I personally do. And I think a lot of the botanists that go out and collect plants are collecting invasives as well, and non-native plants. And they're definitely, maybe we don't do research on them in the Botanical Club, but the herbarium definitely wants specimens of non-native and invasive plants so that we can track their spread, and then in turn the DNR is also tracking them and uses our specimen data to help with that. And I personally am always out there collecting non-native plants because a lot of them are overlooked, like smaller ones, and there's a lot of interesting ones that have invaded the state recently.
Interesting.
John, I wanted to ask you about the Compendium of Flora of Wisconsin, the research project you're working on now. Is it all of the flora for the state of Wisconsin, or is it only native plants?
It is all vascular plants.
All vascular.
So ferns, conifers, and flowering plants, native and non-native in the state. So if it grows in the state as a wild plant, like outside of cultivation, so if it's a non-native plant, did it come into the state on its own or escape from gardens and become a problem like buckthorn or something like that? That would be included in the book. Mm. Cultivated plants that have not escaped, so things like petunias and mums and kale or something like that, would not be included in this.
Mm. So what is your advice for ordinary citizens, I mean, for us as individuals, but also collectively? What do we need to be doing in terms of fostering the presence of native plants in the landscapes around us, including those that we have sort of direct control over? What would you have people do?
I would say that it's important to, you know, even on a basic level, learn some plant identification so that when you're out in the woods or taking a walk somewhere, that you can identify some of the plants around you and learn which ones are native and not native, right? So when you walk through the woods, you might think, oh, this woods is beautiful. It's super lush. There's tons of greenery, and not think anything of it. Think that it's healthy. But if you learn some identification skills and realize that a lot of that greenery that you're seeing is buckthorn or garlic mustard or honeysuckle or something like that, then you would see that the woods in a much different light, right? Because you'd see that maybe this isn't as pristine of a habitat as I thought. Just because it's green doesn't mean that it's necessarily like a healthy ecosystem, right? So this time of year, especially if you drive past any woods almost anywhere in the state, you're going to see that all the trees are changing. But if you see this giant blockade of green underneath those trees, that's honeysuckle and buckthorn, both of which are not native to Wisconsin and are invasive. So even though that forest looks super lush, there's a lot of problems with that forest with all of those invasives in there. So just kind of learning, I think, that basic plant ID can help you better understand a habitat, right, and see if it's in a good or bad condition. And if you've got your own property that has, you know, an old field or a little patch of woods or something like that, being able to identify what's on your property is definitely good, because you can see that, you know, do you have invasives that maybe you should be managing or cutting back or something like that? Or do you have a nice area that's got a lot of beautiful, you know, spring wildflowers or fall asters or something like that in your field? And it just, on one level, gaining an appreciation for those plants, native or non-native, and then learning how can you protect that land that you might own, or even land that you don't own. So maybe if you're in one of those parks in your hometown and you see that it's full of invasives that you've now learned how to identify, you can contact the parks department or whoever might be in charge and say, like, hey, we should be, you know, pulling this garlic mustard every spring so that we can keep this park in good condition and support good habitat for good native insects, birds, whatever it might be, and making these places into much nicer condition than they were.
Hmm. What kind of progress, if you've seen progress, have you seen over the course of your work in this field? I mean, in terms of the general public and kind of an awareness of this whole notion of invasive species, which once upon a time, I think very few ordinary citizens had ever heard anything about. Have we made some significant progress in this respect as far as you're concerned?
I think so. I think that just knowing what an invasive species is something that most people know now. I mean, if you were to walk down the street and say, like, do you know what an invasive species is? They would easily be able to tell you that it's, you know, a species that is not native to this area, comes in, takes over, and they might even be able to give you examples, whether it's garlic mustard or house sparrows or starlings, whatever it might be. So I think we've definitely made a lot of progress there, teaching about these things. And I think on some level, we've made a lot of progress with controlling them too in some areas. So, you know, there's lots of organizations out there that have, you know, worked to restore different habitats. So the different land trusts that are in the state, so Ozaukee Washington Land Trust in the east, Mississippi Valley Conservancy in the western part of the state, just to name two, have identified a lot of properties and controlled the invasive species on them to kind of bring them back to a more natural and much healthier state. And I think people getting involved with those groups, as well as the Botanical Club, has definitely helped, because, you know, if you learn that these things are bad through education, either from the DNR, maybe even at the elementary school level, learning in a biology class, then I'm sure that a lot of people have learned about that and then have wanted to do something about it.
Very good. Nan, you want to add anything for our guest, John Zaborski, before we finish up?
I was just thinking about, it's kind of a hive mind mindset. So you have the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. You have other groups like Wild Ones and the Prairie Enthusiasts. You have the very important organizations known as land trusts, all taking a piece of that and trying to put back together our native habitats, because they are absolutely intrinsically essential to our health as well as the health of the planet in terms of clean water, flood control, species preservation, all kinds of things. So it is very heartening and also inspirational to know that we have all of these organizations working kind of towards the same thing, but doing it in different ways. So there are so many things that people can do, even if you can't plant something because you live in a condo or an apartment. You can support these organizations by volunteering or joining as an organization member. It's a great thing to do.
John, if anybody hearing this is intrigued by what they've heard about the Botanical Club of Wisconsin and wants to find out more information and perhaps even pursue the possibility of joining, what should they do?
They can go to our website, which unfortunately has a very long URL. It's sites.google.com/site/Botanical Club of Wisconsin. Or you can just Google Botanical Club of Wisconsin and we're the first result, which is probably easier. And then from there you can see all the different activities that we hold each year. You can see the ones that we've held in the past. And soon we'll be updating it with what our different monthly meetings will be for this fall and winter coming up. And obviously you can join the club there as well. There's a link to our membership.
Very good. John Zaborski is president of the Botanical Club of Wisconsin. John, we really appreciate you joining us today on the morning show. And we wish you the very, very best with your future exploits with the Botanical Club of Wisconsin, as well as your ongoing work with the Wisconsin State Herbarium. And thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, John.
All right. That was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I hope we get lots of members for the Botanical Club.
Very good. In our closing minute or so, why don't you give us a couple of announcements and of things coming up?
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, Halloween is coming up right around the corner, and our beloved nature centers usually have something going on, and certainly the Haunted Trails of Hawthorne Hollow is no exception. So this is a spooky season spirit at Hawthorne Hollow with a guided hike along candlelit paths while you're being immersed in storytelling. You'll hear scary tales, local lore, and maybe even some bone-chilling sounds. This is a no-jump scary adventure with hot cider and cocoa available for purchase. It's recommended for everyone 10 years and older. You can choose your date, October 21st or October 28th, beginning at 7 p.m. Spaces are limited, so go to the website today. That's where you register and you pick your time and date. Next, of course, we have Pringle Nature Center. They're doing a candlelight Halloween hike on October 29th. Actually, there are multiple hikes, so you have to pick your time and decide when you'd like to go. You're going to celebrate Halloween with a spooky candlelit hike on the trails of Bristol Woods County Park. It's a self-guided and family-friendly, but it might not be suitable for those who have difficulty navigating trails in the dark. Participants check in at the front of Pringle Nature Center during their designated start time before following the candlelit trail through the woods. The fee is $6 for Friends of Pringle, $4.50 for people who are yet to be Friends of Pringle Nature Center. Pre-registration is required by October 28th, and simply visit the website to register. One last announcement. There's something really interesting going on at the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center. On November 6th from 1 till 2:30 p.m., they're having an art class called Decorative Stone Wrapping. I know it sounds odd, but please go to the website to see the pictures. They're really beautiful. This is a Japanese knotting technique without any glue or any fasteners except the material you're using to wrap around the stones. Local artist Marie Andreucci will lead you through the steps to make these meticulously wrapped pieces of stone art, and you'll leave with a stone of your own. So this is, again, November 6th, 1 to 2:30 p.m., $40 per person. Register within the EcoJays website.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Exciting stuff.
It is very exciting.
Great. Nan Calvert, thank you for being here, and we look forward to seeing you in November.
Yes, I'll be back. Happy fall, everybody.
Take care.